Welcome to the Deep Dive, where we take your source material, all those dense articles and historical notes, and we pull out the essential insights. So today, we have a mission for you. We are diving deep into the Book of Mormon.
Right.
And the question we're asking is, well, it's pretty simple, but it's also profound. If this book is not an ancient translation from golden plates, where did Joseph Smith get all the material?
That's the core of it, yeah. Our goal is to do a kind of historical detective work.
Okay.
We're applying the tools of textual criticism, anachronism analysis, to search for historical fingerprints.
Fingerprints, I like that.
Exactly. If this text was really composed in upstate New York between 1827 and 1830, then it should be just saturated with the literature, the culture, the anxieties, even the personal conflicts of that exact time and place.
And those fingerprints would be the proof.
They'd be the proof that the text is a product of its era, not an ancient record.
So let's start with the most obvious fingerprint. I mean, the one that's just impossible to ignore and kind of sets the stage for everything else. The King James Bible.
Absolutely. The King James Bible, and to be specific, the 1769 Revised Edition, is probably the biggest anachronism in the entire book.
Right.
I mean, you have a Book of Mormon narrative that spans from 600 BC to 400 AD. The KJV translation wasn't even finalized until 1611.
Over 1,000 years after the events in the book.
1,000 years.
Yeah.
I know the standard apologetic response, though, that God translated the words into KJV language because that's what sounded, you know, scriptural to Joseph Smith and his audience.
Sure, that's the argument.
But is the problem just about style, or is there a deeper issue here?
Well, it runs much deeper than just style. Think about it. If this text were truly ancient, it should only share material that was present in the oldest biblical texts.
The original sources? Right. Instead, the Book of Mormon incorporates material, including entire verses, that are only present in the King James Version. And it even includes actual translation errors that were unique to the KJV.
So you're saying ancient prophets in America are quoting the mistranslations of 17th century English scholars?
It's very difficult to reconcile. And what's more, the Book of Mormon presents these foundational mythical stories from Genesis, like a literal seven-day creation, Adam and Eve, the Tower of Babel, a global flood. It presents them as factual history.
As things the ancient American prophets knew about.
Exactly. And if the historical foundation the book relies on is itself non-historical, which modern scholarship understands it to be, that just gravely undermines the claim of it being an authentic ancient history.
That really hits the nail on the head. Okay, so moving to style. People often point to the language, right? The repetitive formal phrases like, and it came to pass. They say it's evidence of antiquity. It has that archaic feel.
And that archaic feel is a very deliberate literary choice in Joseph Smith's time, not proof that it was ancient.
What do you mean?
Well, in the early 1800s, if you wanted to write something that felt serious or historical or authoritative, you adopted the formal style of the King James Bible. It was a known trope.
Do we have other examples of this from that period?
We do. The source material points out a couple of great ones. You have the First Book of Napoleon, and maybe even better, the Late War.
The Late War. What was that?
It was a popular, very accessible book back then that recounted the War of 1812. But if you read a passage from it, it sounds like it could have been lifted directly from the Book of Mormon.
Really?
Absolutely. Phrases like, "Now it came to pass that the people of the South," long, winding sentences, that biblical cadence. It was all used to make the subject matter feel more important, more sacred.
So the style of the Book of Mormon wasn't unique at all?
Not at all. Its style was just a 19th century literary device.
Wow. That context is vital. It changes the style from being proof of antiquity to, well, proof of authorship in the 1820s.
Precisely.
Okay, let's shift from the literary style to what is maybe the most pervasive cultural myth of the era, the Mound Builder narrative.
This is a huge one, because the Mound Builder myth, it really provides the entire framework for the Nephite-Lamanite conflict.
So let's unpack the origin of this myth for the listener. Where did it come from?
Okay, so throughout the Ohio Valley and across the U.S., European settlers were finding these massive, really sophisticated earthen mounds and fortifications. Mm-hmm. I mean, they were geometrically precise. They clearly showed advanced engineering. But the settlers, who were steeped in racial prejudice, they just could not accept that the Native Americans they were displacing, who they called dark savage Indians, could have built them.
So they invented a superior race to explain it.
Exactly. They created this widespread cultural myth that the Mounds belonged to a lost, superior, white race that had been sophisticated, civilized, and technologically advanced.
And this race was then wiped out.
Wiped out, according to the myth, by the less civilized, dark-skinned, savage tribes who then became the Native Americans.
And what's just, it's astonishing, is that this myth perfectly mirrors the core Book of Mormon story. A light-skinned, sophisticated civilization, the Nephites, destroyed by a dark-skinned, savage race, the Lamanites.
It's a one-to-one parallel, and this narrative, you have to understand, it wasn't just some interesting folklore, it had a devastating real-world application.
Right. It was used as a justification.
A powerful and, frankly, wicked justification for white settlers to steal land. The story let them claim they weren't taking land from indigenous people, they were taking it back from the savage race, who had supposedly stolen it from their white ancestors.
That's a profoundly racist structure. It dehumanizes indigenous people to justify violence and removal.
It is, and the timing couldn't be more specific.
What do you mean by the timing?
Well, political timing aligns perfectly with when the Book of Mormon was being composed. Our sources cite an archaeologist, Bradley Lepper, who says the idea of mounds being built by vanished white people became an inconvenient truth that was actively used by Andrew Jackson in 1829.
1820.
Used to justify the removal of American Indian tribes from their land.
That's the exact year Joseph Smith was dictating the final parts of the Book of Mormon.
Yeah.
The language of the era was just inescapable.
It was everywhere. We even find these stunning parallels from famous people. William Henry Harrison, who would become president, he described these ancient advanced people who built the mounds and were then forced to fly from a more numerous or more gallant people.
It's a near perfect blueprint for the tragic ending of the Nephites in the Book of Mormon.
It really is.
So if this myth was so pervasive in the culture, was there one specific text that stands out as maybe a likely source of influence for Joseph Smith?
There is a very strong candidate. It's a book called View of the Hebrews by a man named Ethan Smith.
No relation to Joseph Smith.
No relation, but, and this is notable, he was the minister of Oliver Cowdery, who would become Joseph's main scribe.
Wow, okay.
And this book, published before the Book of Mormon, shared the exact same core worldview. That Native Americans were descendants of the lost tribes of Israel, that they divided into light and dark groups, and that their history ended in a great annihilation war over the land.
So both books are just drawing from the same cultural well.
Absolutely. But one claims to be translated ancient scripture, and the other is just a 19th century speculation. And, you know, the weight of this parallel was recognized even inside the church decades later.
You're talking about the analysis by B.H. Roberts, right? He was a general authority, a high-ranking leader in the church.
That's right. In 1927, B.H. Roberts wrote this paper detailing what he called the uncanny similarities between View of the Hebrews and the Book of Mormon.
And what did he find?
He noted that they shared so many major elements. Jewish people sailing to an empty continent, dividing into civilized and uncivilized groups, a buried sacred record, the final annihilation war. And Roberts, looking at this as a faithful insider, he confessed that the sheer volume of these parallels was a serious menace to Joseph Smith's story of the Book of Mormon's origin.
A serious menace. That admission, coming from a high-ranking leader, it just underscores how hard it is to dismiss these influences as coincidence.
It really does. It shows that even back in the 1920s, scholars inside the church could see that the text was responding directly to the popular ideas of the 1820s.
Okay, so we've covered these broader literary and cultural fingerprints. Let's narrow our focus now to Joseph Smith himself. Let's look at what he was actually doing and experiencing while he was composing this text.
Right.
Starting with his history with folk magic and treasure digging.
Yeah, this is key. Joseph Smith spent years working as a treasure seeker. He used a stone placed in a hat, a practice called scrying, to try and locate buried riches.
This was a disreputable practice, right? He got into legal trouble for it.
He did. It was seen as disreputable, but it was central to his life right before the Book of Mormon came out.
And this personal kind of local practice, it's literally written into the Book of Mormon.
It is. The source material points to descriptions of cursed riches in the earth that become slippery and slip away when people try to hide them. You see this in books like Helaman and Mormon.
Slippery treasures.
That whole concept wasn't some ancient American idea. It was a well-known piece of 18th century folk magic lore tied to the exact kind of treasure digging Joseph Smith was doing. It's a clear autobiographical fingerprint.
And if Joseph was known as a disreputable scryer or a peeper, how does he deal with that low social status in the text itself?
He elevates it. Massively. The translation really picked up speed when Oliver Cowdery arrived as the scribe. And in the Book of Mosiah, chapter 8, which was written around that time, the text defines a seer as someone who can know of things which are past and also of things which are to come. And then it makes this stunning declaration. A seer is greater than a prophet.
So Joseph Smith is using the voice of God in his own scripture to legitimize his controversial past.
And to claim a status that's superior to established biblical prophets. Yes. It serves a very clear, self-serving purpose to validate his personal practice and establish his authority.
And this theme of self-validation, it extends to his attempts to prove the book was prophesied anciently, right? Often by inserting contemporary events into the scripture.
Exactly. The text has these unmistakable self-serving prophecies, like predicting a great prophet named Joseph, who is the son of Joseph.
A little on the nose.
It's a classic case of writing hindsight into the past. But he went even further. He retrofitted a specific real-life event into the ancient text.
You're talking about the Martin Harris visit to Professor Charles Anthon.
I am. Martin Harris takes these characters, supposedly copied from the plates, to Professor Anthon in New York to get academic validation. Anthon tells him it's basically meaningless symbols.
All right.
So then, when Joseph Smith writes the Book of Mormon, he inserts a passage in 2 Nephi that prophesies this exact interaction. A learned man is asked to read this, I pray thee, and the learned man replies that he cannot read a sealed book.
He turned a recent trip, a failed validation attempt, into the fulfillment of an ancient prophecy.
He did. He retrofitted a contemporary event into the scripture to bolster his credibility. And what's more, scholars believe he fundamentally misinterpreted Isaiah 29, which is about spiritual blindness, to make it seem like it referred to the physical, sealed portion of his book.
So we've covered culture, his career. But maybe the most intimate fingerprint is his relationship with his father. You're saying Joseph Smith inserted his own father's dream into the text.
Yes. Joseph Smith Sr. had this powerful vision in 1811 of the Tree of Life. And it is remarkably similar to Lehi's dream in 1 Nephi.
How similar?
The shared details are uncanny. A desolate field, a narrow path, a stream of water, an iron rod or rope to hold, a great and spacious building full of finely dressed people mocking them, and this beautiful white fruit.
So he incorporated his father's foundational life experience directly into his sacred text. That's a validation of his father's own visionary nature.
It was a beautiful validation, yes, but it served a dual purpose. Because Joseph then used the text to correct his father's theology.
How so?
Well, Joseph Smith Sr. was a universalist. He believed everyone would eventually be saved. This caused a lot of religious tension with his wife, Lucy, who was a much more traditional Calvinist.
So the son uses the voice of ancient scripture to settle a family argument.
That's how it appears. In Nephi 15, the prophet reinterprets Lehi's vision, explaining that the stream of water was actually filthiness and the great gulf was a representation of that awful hell.
So it corrects the universalist idea.
Perfectly. It asserts that not everyone would be saved, resolving the long-standing religious dispute between his parents in favor of his mother's view.
Okay, let's wrap this up by looking at the most immediate political fears circulating in New York at the time and how they show up in the book. Specifically, the anti-Masonic fervor.
Right. So in 1826, a man named William Morgan disappeared after planning to expose Masonic secrets. This led to this massive wave of political and cultural anxiety all through upstate New York.
People were afraid of Masonic vengeance.
They were terrified of their secret combinations. This anti-Masonic sentiment became a huge political force between 1826 and 1830.
And the Book of Mormon's consistent focus on secret combinations, these shadowy groups that caused the fall of nations, that directly mirrors this political discourse.
It was so explicit, so timely, that Martin Harris himself publicly called the Book of Mormon the anti-Masonic Bible. The Ohio Star newspaper later reported that every follower of the book they could find was an anti-Mason. The text was clearly tapping into the biggest political fear of its day.
That connection is just so hard to rationalize as a coincidence. And finally, let's just quickly revisit the loss of the first 116 manuscript pages by Martin Harris. Did Joseph Smith insert his reaction to that into the text too?
It seems so. The loss was a huge, traumatic event for him. When he resumed translation, in Mosiah chapter 4, a chapter written right after the lost King Benjamin, delivers this very unique, specific warning.
What's the warning?
He says, "Whosoever among you borroweth of his neighbor should return the thing that he borroweth, or else thou shalt commit sin, and perhaps thou shalt cause thy neighbor to commit sin also.
That doesn't sound like generic advice. That sounds incredibly pointed.
It's widely seen as Joseph Smith writing a direct emotional reprimand to Martin Harris right into the ancient record, scolding him for losing the borrowed manuscript. It's another perfect example of a 19th century personal conflict dictating the content of supposed ancient scripture.
So what does this all mean for you, the listener? We followed the evidence across, what, four major categories?
Mm-hmm.
Literary style, the cultural context of the Mound Builder myth, personal details from Joseph's own life, and immediate political anxieties.
And when you look at this mountain of evidence, all these specific non-ancient details, and you take away the assumption of divine origin, the text overwhelmingly points to being a product of the 19th century, but also a highly personalized one.
These aren't just vague coincidences.
No, they're specific, historical, cultural, and often autobiographical fingerprints that really only Joseph Smith could have left.
The ultimate takeaway here seems to be that scholarship and historical evidence allow you to assess the claims based on what the text itself contains rather than what you're told it must be.
And that struggle is still happening. Think back to the Mound Builder myth. That archaeologist, Bradley Lepper, he notes that he constantly deals with people who insist the mounds prove the Book of Mormon. And when he presents the historical evidence, the timing, the racism, the context we discussed, they accuse him of lying and hiding the evidence. And this raises the most important question for you, the critical thinker. When you're faced with this volume of external and internal evidence, are you willing to work with the data presented by scholars and historians? Or does your belief system require you to assume that professionals are actively hiding the evidence to keep you from the truth? That is the real test of where you place your trust.